This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Ray McGovern joins us to talk about Special Prosecutor Mueller's indictments last week, including that of Paul Manafort.
McGovern is the ultimate Washington, D.C. insider, and he's on our side.
Last week, a portion of the files relating to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy were released.
The rest of them are supposed to be released in 6 months, but the CIA controls what's going to come out. But they don't control our next guest. He's the author of The Devil's Chessboard. It's a biography of ex-CIA head Alan Dulles, who JFK fired, and who then covered up the assassination.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Paul Manafort, who had been Donald Trump's campaign manager, was indicted last week by Special Prosecutor Mueller for 12 counts of money laundering involving at least $18 million, setting up a secret overseas bank account through which $75 million flowed, lying to federal authorities, and operating as an unregistered foreign agent for the president of the Ukraine, tax evasion and conspiracy. Also indicted was his colleague Rick Gates. Manafort was a Washington insider. He graduated from Georgetown Law School and went on to work for Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. He then became, by his own description, an influence peddler. He was a political advisor to the vicious dictatorships of Marcos in the Philippines and Mobutu in Zaire, helping them avoid trouble with the United States. He made millions of dollars advising the elected head of the government of the Ukraine before he was overthrown in a coup approved of and supported by the United States, in particular by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who held that position under the Obama administration before she ran for president. Along with the indictments, it was disclosed that George Papadopoulos, a former volunteer advisor to Trump during his campaign, had pled guilty to lying to the FBI about having ties with the Russians and was cooperating with the prosecution. He had urged Trump to meet with Russian officials. We speak today with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern about these much-anticipated developments. McGovern works with the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner-city Washington, D.C. During his 27-year career at the CIA, he prepared the president's daily brief for Nixon, Ford, and Reagan, and conducted the one-on-one briefings from 1981 to 1985. He is the co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
Ray McGovern, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you for calling in from your hotel room, and we have to acknowledge to listeners that there's a little buzz, but we're not surprised.
Well, that's the problem with interviewing Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst.
Right.
You come with a lot of baggage.
Well, more the merrier.
Were you surprised, Ray, that Paul Manafort was the first person to be charged in the special prosecutor's probe?
Not really. They're trying to in the trade we say flip them. Bob Mueller is trying to get him on all kinds of unrelated charges in hopes that he'll either spill the beans on Trump, or he'll make up stuff on Trump. Or, if he doesn't make up stuff on Trump, we have a very willing Federal Bureau of Investigation that's quite capable of making up stuff and saying, Paul, you sign here and you only get 1 year. Okay, so that's how bad it is. I'm not surprised. What really I'm surprised at is that the commentators in the progressive media, I'm talking about Truth Out, I'm talking about Democracy Now. Yesterday, when Democracy Now talked about this story, they felt it necessary to say alleged for the first time about alleged Russian hacking. And then when they quoted Trump as saying this has nothing to do with Russia, the speaker said, and he's correct about that, and blah, 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 blah. It was a little like sotto voce. Well, yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with Russia, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, what we have here is a situation where the mainstream press, including what used to be the alternative media, progressive type, have all bought into what I call the HWHW virus syndrome. And that is, as you will remember, after the election, there was the equivalent of PTSD among people who fully expected 95% that Hillary would win. Now, PTSD is one way to describe it, and I think it's a very accurate description. What I use is a virus that went wild right after the election. I call it the HWHW virus, and it stands for Hillary would have won. Okay, now, it couldn't be that Hillary Clinton was a terrible candidate, that people knew that she stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders, and nobody trusted her. That couldn't be it. That couldn't be why she lost. So I have to think of an external reason. What's better than Vladimir Putin, Eminence Grise, Bete Noire, and all the other appellations you can think of? They blamed it on him, and they had already prepared the way by accusing the Russians of hacking and deliberately trying to interfere with our democracy, whatever that's supposed to mean. So, no, I wasn't surprised at Manafort. The only question I have now, Manafort could do big time for these legitimate crimes. He's a sleaze, let's face it. Trump was very misguided in hiring him on. So will he either squeal or succumb to the blandishments of enticement to get off a big rap? We'll have to see about that. But in any case, we've looked at it very, very closely. The Russia Gate is what my British friends call rubbish.
Ray, let me play devil's advocate for a second, because
sure.
By the time this segment airs, it will have been last week when the big tech giants of social media, such as Facebook, Twitter, were on Capitol Hill testifying and saying, in their words, that over 100 million people in the U.S. may have been exposed to ads on social media that they say were produced by Russian government-backed agents to try to spread disinformation and sow social discord here related to the campaign. What do you say to that?
Well, I hate to say it again, rubbish. Now, the way this played out was these high-tech people, Google and Twitter and Facebook, they didn't come up with the right answer right off the bat. And so the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee went out to Silicon Valley, and he said, hey, come on. I sit on the committee that regulates you guys, and you got to do better than saying that there was no effect on the election. And surprise, surprise, they've done better, but better in a laughable sense. To find credible claims that $100,000 invested in some ads swung the election or had any effect on the election, and we're talking about billions of dollars being invested in these Facebook and other outlets, it's ludicrous. And what do they show? Well, unless you believe that Russia is the old Soviet Union that is trying to subvert our democracy, unless you believe that, then it's still a stretch, because how are they subverting our democracy by replaying things from Black Lives Matter, from other divisive issues that are all over our TV stations? So, pardon me, but even when these people are finished testifying this week, it's going to be really laughable to look really closely at it, because Facebook, Twitter, Google, they all have major, major reasons to dovetail their presentation with what the HWHW folks, the Hillary would have won folks, pursue. So I wouldn't give any credence to it at all. If you look really closely at it, it's on its face.
Is there any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign, including Trump, colluded with the Russian government in the course of the campaign?
Well, number one, colluded is not ipso facto a crime, as you lawyers know. I learned that by listening to Jonathan Turley on the radio yesterday. You have to conclude in a crime, right? Now, what's the crime? Let's say they get about Manafort or someone else to say, yeah, we talked to 18 Russians, and we wanted them to help out in the campaign, you know. And we didn't pay them any money because they were happy to do it because Putin really wanted Hillary to lose. Suppose they get that. That's still not colluding. Now, the way this thing went down, and people need to know this, is you've got James Comey and now Bob Mueller, who's the special counsel, being glorified in the New York Times, Washington Post, as being incredibly honorable men. They are not. How did Bob Mueller get appointed a special counsel? Well, we know, because James Comey has admitted it. He was no longer head of the FBI, but all his friends were still there, and he had his friends leak to the New York Times that the president told him, Comey, that he should let Mike Flynn off easy. You know, oh, that's interfering, that's obstructing justice, and so forth. So that's leaked to the New York Times. Now, when they asked Comey, why'd you do that? He said, well, because I wanted a special counsel appointed as quickly as possible. And indeed, he was the next day. Thank you, Jesus, my prayers were. who's Mueller? Mueller's his best friend, his former associate. And I have to say, without exaggeration, his partner in crime. They approved the eavesdropping. They knew about the torture and didn't say anything about it. They knew that the evidence, such as it was before the attack against Saddam Hussein, was bogus. They knew all those things. They didn't say what they should have said. They are not honorable men in any sense of the word. And I know Colleen Rowley, my colleague and veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity, can attest to that and actually has written a memo or an article for Huffington Post that lists the long list of Mueller's record, starting with his acting United States attorney in Boston, where he covered up, and I'm saying covered up, murders by Whitey Bulger and his associates, who were agents, who were paid agents of the FBI. Mueller knew about it. He covered it up. He covered up 9/11. And Colleen Rowley is the expert on that. She wrote him two memos. And he proceeded in covering up, even though he came a week after 9/11, he knew all the mistakes that the FBI did, and he covered them up. You know, I had a personal experience with Bob Mueller. 3 years ago, I was at Georgetown University, together with about 100 other people. I was in the audience, and the Q&A came, and as the skunk at the picnic, I raised my hand first, and I got recognized. So I said, Mr. Mueller, I'm interested in whether you have any legal qualms about what you call parallel construction. For those of you who don't know, I said parallel construction is where you take illegally acquired sensitive information, like from wiretaps or electronic surveillance, you give that to local law enforcement, and you say, now don't tell anybody where you got this, but you want to get these guys? Here's the information. And then they tell them, look, when you arraign these guys, when you prosecute them, for God's sake, don't tell them how you got the information originally. So, these people are being suborned into perjury, not only before the court and the judge, but they're denying the defense counsel the information as to how this was illegally obtained. So anyhow, I said, Mr. Mueller, do you have any legal qualms about that? He looked at me, he's a big guy, and I looked right down at him. He said, Mr. McGovern, after 9/11, we were given special authorities.
Nice.
Whoa. That's what it is. You know, you've heard it 100 times. After 9/11, everything changed, and that includes certain amendments called the Bill of Rights to our Constitution.
Well, there's been speculation. Partisan politics are going to beat back Prosecutor Mueller's investigation. I'm not sure that I agree with that. But what concerns me is that even if his investigation and the prosecution is successful against sleazes like Manafort, Trump has got the power to pardon them. So why should anybody flip when they know that Trump's got their back?
You know, Michael, I have to tell you, I hadn't thought of that, but that's exactly right. So, you know, this thing will play out. It will play out until the next election, which is next November, right? Following November. And what you have is Nancy Pelosi waiting in the wings, in the same way she did when she was minority leader in the House and became Speaker again in 2006. Now, what am I talking about? I'm talking about Nancy Pelosi being able to impeach a president named George W. Bush, who, if any president deserved impeachment for a war of aggression, he did, and associated crimes like torture, kidnapping, black prisons, and the rest of it. So, John Conyers comes into chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee in the House, and Cindy Sheehan and I go visit him. And he said, "What do you want?" And we said, "Well, we're hoping that you'll impeach George W. Bush." And he looks at us and he says, "No, that's off the table." And I say, "Sir, it's in the Constitution. If a war of aggression is not an impeachable crime, nothing is." He said, "Look, Nancy Pelosi says it's off the table." I said, "Why?" And he said this, get this, "Because if we appear divisive before the next by-election, we will not win as big, okay? Not by-election, the next election, okay?" And I thought, wow, that is the most cynical thing I've ever heard, you know? And then, and get this, my NSA colleague said, "Ray, for God's sake, don't you know that Nancy Pelosi approved torture? That she approved illegal eavesdropping? That NSA has the records on that, and so does the CIA memo of conversation that always followed a meeting with Nancy Pelosi? That's at least an additional, if not the main reason, why Nancy Pelosi was not going to risk impeaching George W. Bush." Now, what did Nancy Pelosi say yesterday? "We should have an independent investigation. It's not enough to have six in Congress and Mueller. Now we need another independent." You know where I'm headed here. She yeah. wants to keep the pot boiling until the next election, where she expects everybody to vote against Trump. I'm not sure that's going to work, but whether it works or not, it's in my judgment, an impeachable offense against Nancy Pelosi.
Well, so what would it take to get Trump impeached if he fires Mueller?
Well, you know, my attitude is this. People say, "Well, so you're noncommittal on Trump." No, I'm not noncommittal. I'm not noncommittal. I think he should be impeached. I have 9 grandchildren. They're not going to be able to have clean water to drink and clean air to breathe when they get to be my age, if not before. Is that not enough reason to impeach a clown like Trump? And, you know, if you need more, get 4 or 5 more. You don't impeach Trump on a lie about him colluding with Russia, because the evidence is not there and it's being exploited for political purposes. You impeach him for other reasons, and I hope that that goes forward, but it's going to take Pelosi and the others to start acting like patriots and not acting like partisan politicos.
Ray, we wanted to ask you, given that the Kennedy files were supposed to have been released to the public last week, and not all were, isn't that a violation of the terms that had been agreed to?
Well, as lawyers, you know, there's always a little escape clause, and the law permitted the president at his discretion to withhold or redact certain parts of it. Now, that was 25 years ago, Heidi. 25 years. You'd think that the people in the CIA would have had enough time to make a convincing case that this or that needs to be excised. Now, what could those things be? Well, could they have to do with Lyndon Johnson? Could they have to do with George H.W. Bush? Could they have simply to do with what the CIA did and its role in the murder of JFK? Well, we don't know, but we're never going to know. And 6 months from now, don't hold your breath, we won't know then either. So, the bottom line of this, or the takeaway, is that Trump, in my view, really thought he could get this done. And he didn't realize until the afternoon of when the term expired of the 25 years that there was no way that the deep state was going to allow this. And who's running Washington right now? Well, I'm sorry to say, it's not Trump, as bad as that would be. It's the deep state, and here's the latest proof of it. I can give you all kinds of other proof that Obama was afraid of the deep state as well, and, for example, did everything he possibly could to prevent the emergence of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA torture based on original CIA documents. Obama fought tooth and nail to prevent the Senate committee from releasing that before the Senate changed terms and Dianne Feinstein left the chairmanship. And I can prove that. I mean, I know the guy who led the investigation. 4 years they labored hard on this. They redacted the heck out of it, and still the president was arguing John Brennan, the head of the CIA's case, saying, no, national security. That's how bad it was. And there are lots of other instances of Obama succumbing to pressure from not only the CIA, but the military as well. So there is a deep state, and it is very active, and we see its success lately in... Try to get this thing off here. Just a second.
Sure. And Ray, I wanted to just add that we've interviewed Mike Lofgren on Law and Disorder, and he's written a book called The Deep State. He's described it as a hybrid association of elements of government and parts of top-level finance and industry that is effectively able to govern the U.S. without reference to the consent of the governed, as expressed through the formal political process. Do you think that's an adequate definition there?
Mike is a very bright guy. I know him well. He's a friend, and he's got it exactly right in the broader sense. So when General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, talked about the deep state, I'm sorry, when he talked about the military-industrial complex, he wanted to add congressional as well. Now, his advisors said, now, come on, Ike. Military-industrial has taken on quite enough. Don't add Congress. Congress should, of course, have been added even then, now for sure. And now we have a burgeoning intelligence apparatus, and we have a media that is handmaiden to this this military-industrial congressional media complex. So I've never seen it quite bad, quite so bad. You know, the Gray Lady up there in New York, where I lived my first 22 years, if you read the Gray Lady in the morning, that's the New York Times, of course, you were informed. Now, I go up to see my old friends from Fordham, and I talk to them, and they say, McGovern, where did you get that crazy notion? And I say, what do you mean crazy? I can prove it. And they say, you can't prove it. It's not in the New York Times. So I've been saying that the Gray Lady has become a lady of the night.
Getting back to the Kennedy assassination, I believe, and I'm sure you agree with me, that that was really a turning point in American and world history. And I further believe, and this was entrenched by my reading James R. Douglas's book on the assassination of Kennedy, that the CIA was heavily involved in it. I suspect that the papers that were supposed to be released never will, or they'll be so heavily redacted that we won't be able to tell, that any evidence that would support that conclusion of the CIA involvement in a coup, really, against the president is going to be suppressed. And 6 months from now, when the CIA is supposed to release the remaining documents, my projection is that nothing good's going to come of it. What do you think?
Well, I expect to be still looking at the grass from the top 6 months from now, and I don't expect to be educated any more than I am now by the redactions, by whatever Trump persuades Pompeo and his folks to release. Now, the thing to remember here is Pompeo isn't in charge either. The titular leaders of the deep state, like Pompeo, can't get a straight answer from the people who work for Brennan. I mean, why else would President Trump be saying, no, the hacking, oh, yeah, the Russian hacking, could be the Russians, could be the Chinese, could be. Now, come on. All Pompeo has to do is convene all those cyber warfare experts that work for John Brennan, get them in the room and say, all right, give us the real scoop. How did this go down? How did the Russians become blamed for that one so-called hack that we know was not a hack, that was rather a copy onto a thumb drive, and that we know that was done as an inside job inside the DNC headquarters in the Eastern time zone, not Vladivostok, but Washington and New York. We know all that. Now you tell us how you did that, or you tell us how you helped the CrowdStrike do that, or the DNC. Now he could get the answers, maybe. And that's the big thing, maybe. These people don't have to tell them the truth, and as far as I can tell, Pompeo is completely oblivious of how the intelligence community works, and as head of the CIA, that's, I suppose, a virtue in terms of how the system works in the deep state. The deep state would really like to stay real deep. They don't need to fully inform people like Pompeo.
Well, we're running out of our allotted time. We only have a few more minutes, Ray McGovern. Where do you think things are heading? I'm 75. You're a couple years older than I am, I think. Heidi's a much younger presence here. But nevertheless, we've all been around the block. My own feeling is that things have never been scarier in my political lifetime. Where do you think things are going?
Well, you know, from a strategic point of view, things are more dicey now. The Germans say labile. It means really tentative, you know, kind of really dicey. They haven't been that way so badly since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I remember that well, okay? That's when I entered active duty in the U.S. Army as an officer in intelligence and infantry exactly 55 years ago, so I remember that. All the weapons we were supposed to train with in Fort Benning were at Key West. You know, that's an immediate experience of that. Now I see that no one's paying any attention to how the Russians are looking at all this stuff. When we're building anti-ballistic missile systems all around the Russian periphery, that's bad. That's bad because it's destabilizing. There is no anti-ballistic missile treaty anymore. And so Putin, he can go to his generals and say, now don't worry about it. The ABM project is just really, it's a job. It's a corporate welfare system. They're making billions. They'll never work. Now, Putin can't say that to his generals. And his generals say, look, we have to plan for the worst. Therefore, Mr. President, we're going to launch on warning, as we used to do before the ABM treaty in 72. That's the only option we have. Otherwise, we lose our entire strategic capability. That, Mike and Heidi, is really concerning.
That's quite a sobering note on which to end. Ray McGovern, it's always a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder, and we thank you for keeping it real.
Well, you're most welcome.
Ray McGovern, thanks so much for being on the program. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. For archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy on November 22, 1963, 54 years ago, was a turning point in American and world history. The official story has been put forward in the Warren Commission report. It stated that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin and that there was no conspiracy. Oswald himself said before he was assassinated that he was a patsy. The official story has been widely debunked. It is not believed by some 60% of the American people. Oliver Stone's 1991 movie JFK led to the reopening of the investigation by a committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. The committee concluded that there was a conspiracy. They passed a law signed in 1992 by President George H.W. Bush, calling for the release of all remaining intelligence files on the assassination by October 26, 2017. Last week, about half of the remaining documents were released. The remaining documents must be released within 6 months unless President Trump decides not to. The intelligence agencies have a say-so in what further documents will be released, but ultimately it's the president's decision. It is not believed that the release of the documents will contradict the official story that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin and that there was no conspiracy. James R. Douglas wrote the definitive book on the Kennedy assassination, demonstrating conclusively that it was the work of the CIA. Why? Because the intelligence agency wanted to stop Kennedy from withdrawing American troops from the Vietnam War, and he wanted and was working toward a peaceful resolution of the Cold War with respect to American policy toward both the Soviet Union and Cuba. We speak today with David Talbot, the author of the book The Devil's Chessboard, which outlines the role that CIA Director Alan Dulles, who was fired by John F. Kennedy, played in both orchestrating the assassination and its cover-up when he was appointed by Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy's successor, to the Warren Commission. David Talbot, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about the beginnings of the Dulles family in America and a little bit about their ancestry.
Well, they are a family that's very much a part of what C. Wright Mills, the sociologist, later called the power elite in his famous book in the 1950s. And these were men, in the case of John Foster Dulles and his brother, Alan, or boys at the time, who were born to power. Their family were included two secretaries of state, lawyers, people who were quite comfortable, you know, running the country. And the boys literally sat at the knee of that power as they grew up. Not a particularly wealthy family. Their father was a very committed Presbyterian minister who would literally give you the coat off his back, as he did in the case of one poor parishioner. And he wasn't a terribly acquisitive man himself, their father. But nor were the brothers particularly in the case of Alan Dulles. But they were very concerned with power, how to accumulate it and how to manipulate it.
And they had that Calvinist streak and that belief in the exceptional quality of America, which I thought you wrote about so well. Talk a little bit about that, would you please?
Yeah, well, their father is a Presbyterian minister, and though he himself is a modest man and a progressive man in many ways, he does have a missionary streak, and the boys inherit that. Now, they're not particularly religious themselves, but their missionary streak involves American power and extending that power, that dominion, throughout the world. And so that's the kind of, I think, Calvinist or missionary streak that they inherit, Foster and Alan. You know, this became very much sort of the ideology, of course, of the 20th century. Henry Luce, the great press baron who founded the Time Life Empire, you know, he penned a famous piece during World War II that declared the American century and that it was America's right and in fact, obligation. And he saw it almost in religious terms, too, to build this imperial dominion throughout the world, not in the old-fashioned sense where, you know, the great European powers would hold land and hold colonies, but to really extend our influence through military means, through intelligence, through corporate means, and cultural ideology.
If you will, tell us a bit about the brothers' Wall Street law firm Sullivan and Cromwell and who some of their clients were.
So the Dulles brothers emerge in the power sphere really by taking over and running the most important and largest law firm on Wall Street, Sullivan and Cromwell. And this, you know, really is the leading law firm for the major corporate brands and financial institutions throughout America, and not just America, but globally. This is a global, you know, power nexus. So, in fact, some of its greatest fortune, Sullivan and Cromwell, comes from working with German clients emerging from World War I as Germany begins to rebuild after that devastating war. And a number of the major powers, corporate powers that they're dealing with as clients are companies that later become quite notorious during the Third Reich, the rise of Hitler, companies like IG Farben and Krupp Steel. IG Farben, of course, was the chemical conglomerate that manufactured, among other things, the pesticide Zyklon B that was used in the death camps to exterminate Jews. So they had no compunctions about dealing with companies like this well into Hitler's rise. And it was only under great pressure from within the law firm and that Foster Dulles, who is the chief counsel there, is finally forced to shut down their Berlin office and to begin to pull back somewhat from their connections to the German economy and the Nazi regime. Although those connections, as I write about in my book, continued in a covert way through World War II and into the post-war years.
And they helped Nazi war criminals escape justice. Talk about that, please.
Well, you know, Alan Dulles gets himself sent over to Switzerland during World War II as our top spy working for the OSS, which was the U.S. spy agency during World War II. He doesn't want to go to London, where he'll be under closer supervision. He wants to go to Switzerland. He has a history there. He's worked out of Switzerland before as a spy. He, as I say, has connections to German business interests. The Swiss banks, although Switzerland was ostensibly neutral during World War II, Swiss banks were operating basically as laundering mechanisms for Nazi loot. And he uses his perch in Switzerland, where he has very little immediate supervision from back home in Washington because he's so far away and because the Nazis have, of course, cut off Switzerland from the outside world. So he can do pretty much whatever he pleases. And what he goes about doing is trying to cut a separate deal with Nazi forces, and he finally succeeds in doing this with Karl Wolff, who is the SS commander, head of all security forces in Italy for the Nazis, in an operation called Operation Sunrise. Well, this was in direct defiance of President Roosevelt's policy of unconditional surrender. We're not going to deal with the Nazis. We're not going to cut a separate deal with them. We're going to crush this evil regime and bring its leaders to justice. Well, Dulles didn't get the memo, so to speak, and he was more intent on cutting deals with Nazis, including some high-level ones, representatives of Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, of all people, because he was more concerned about the Soviet Union coming after World War II and checking its power. And he thought that Germany, even a Germany that included former members of the Nazi regime, should be kept as a powerful bulwark against the Soviet Union. So he sets up these so-called Nazi rat lines, these escape routes that allowed Nazis to escape over the Alps, then through Italy, and then overseas. In fact, he even installs one of the more notorious Nazis, the Hitler spymaster on the bloody Eastern Front, a man named Reinhard Gehlen. He installs him after the war as the top spymaster in democratic post-war West Germany, a position that Gehlen holds throughout much of the Cold War, and forms a kind of sinister alliance between the CIA and this former Nazi.
The idea that Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles had was that they were on the defensive against an aggressive, expanding Soviet Union. I think that notion kind of stands the truth on its head. And I wanted you to comment on their anti-communism.
Well, there's certainly no denying that Stalin was a monster to his own people, that millions perished under his despotic rule, and that is obviously a historical fact. It's undeniable. But what I try to show in this book is that the United States, during these Cold War years, was capable of great evil itself. And encountering the evil of Stalin, in some ways, our intelligence empire, our security empire under Alan Dulles went even further. So torture, mass surveillance of private citizens, extraordinary rendition, CIA black sites, human experimentation, mind control experimentation, political assassinations, all these things that Dulles ironically accused the Soviet Union of, his own agency was really in some ways pioneering in all these techniques long before 9/11. These were all techniques that the CIA under Alan Dulles was employing through the Cold War. So, yeah, I think we need to have a historical, a balanced historical look at what happened in those years, and not only acknowledge the evils that were committed by Stalin and other Soviet leaders, but also by our own leaders. And these were men who felt they were above the law, that democracy was something too important to be left in the hands of you and me and our elected representatives. This was, as C. Wright Mills called them, the power elite, or today many scholars refer to as the deep state. And the kind of forces that they represent are anathema, the secret forces of secrecy and permanent war. These are anathema to a healthy democracy.
David, let's talk about Alan Dulles' role at the beginning of the CIA.
Well, Alan Dulles is in some ways, although he's not the first director of the CIA, he's the father of the CIA. As soon as he comes back from World War II, he goes back to his Wall Street firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, but he continues to operate in the shadows in the intelligence world, and he's pushing right away for a powerful agency like the CIA, and it finally is signed into law in 1947 by President Harry Truman. Well, Harry Truman thought he was just creating basically an intelligence gathering agency that could funnel the best information to the White House. But in fact, what Dulles and his allies build in the CIA is much more of a covert weapon, a weapon of violence, of secrecy. And in fact, Harry Truman later came to believe, and he wrote an op-ed piece, in fact, in the Washington Post after the Kennedy assassination, saying that in some ways the CIA had become a Frankenstein that was not only threatening democracies overseas, but threatening our own democracy at home. So this was a startling essay that the former president wrote. And that's exactly what Dulles and his cohorts had in mind. They thought that American power, basically the American empire, as American corporate power expands around the world, needed this covert cloak-and-dagger arm to go about doing sort of the dirty business that empires require.
Well, yeah, let's talk about some examples of that, David. The overthrow of the democratically elected government in Iran, the overthrow of the reform government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala the year after, the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. These were all things that Alan Dulles was behind, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Absolutely, and in each case, of course, the CIA and its allies promote an image of these leaders, popular elected leaders in these countries, Iran, the Congo, and Guatemala, as mortal threats to U.S. interests and as communist sympathizers or as out-and-out communists, all of which were untrue. And, of course, we see the same kind of demonizing of the enemy today during the War on Terror, often in the most extreme terms. But these, in fact, were nationalist leaders who were trying to uplift their country. They'd come to power through the popular will and had posed threats of one sort or another, not to freedom and to the American way of life, but to American corporate interests and Western corporate interests, the oil industry interests in the case of Iran, agribusiness and United Fruit, which was a major power throughout Latin America in those years and happened to be represented by the Dulles brothers law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. And so when Arbenz, for instance, in Guatemala, and he's kind of the Kennedy of Guatemala, married to a wealthy wife, he's a glamorous couple, but they're very committed to uplifting the poor in that almost medieval country. And one of the key ways they did that was try to redistribute land that was not being used by United Fruit, which basically owned the country, this major U.S. agribusiness firm. And as soon as he starts to do that, of course, antagonize those U.S. corporate interests, his days are numbered, and he's overthrown in the CIA-sponsored coup. And then I tell the story of that. Even then, they wouldn't leave Arbenz and his family alone. They're forced into exile after this coup, and it begins this kind of tragedy that mirrors the tragedy of Guatemala itself, where the family can't find one country that will take it in. The U.S. State Department under Foster Dulles and the CIA are pressuring country after country not to give haven to the Arbenz family. His daughter kills herself. He's finally found in a bathtub in Mexico City, scalded to death. That's how he ends his life. The authorities called it a suicide, but his family to this day is convinced he was murdered. And the CIA, in fact, did maintain a death list in Guatemala of other oppositional political figures besides Arbenz, activists, union leaders, farm worker activists, many of whom were indeed eliminated during the terrible killing fields of Guatemala that went for years after the CIA coup there in 1954. So it's a trail of tears that Alan Dulles' CIA leaves behind throughout the world.
Yeah, I wanted to turn our attention first to Cuba, David, and then on to the JFK assassination. You know, Che Guevara was in Guatemala in 1954. He went there to work as a doctor. He saw what the United States did to the Arbenz government, and he later wrote when he met Fidel Castro in Mexico soon thereafter, he said, "It didn't take much for me to be convinced that I should work towards overthrowing these kinds of undemocratic regimes and restore democracy in Latin America. And he signed on to go to Cuba with Fidel to overthrow the Batista dictatorship. And that brings me to my question about Cuba. What was Dulles's attitude towards the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro?
Well, again, he saw Fidel Castro, this charismatic nationalist who was wanting to establish sovereignty for his own nation, this country that was basically a colony of the U.S. and U.S. corporate interests for many years. And he saw that as a threat to companies like Standard Oil, to the big agribusiness firms that basically owned that island. And immediately, or soon thereafter, after Fidel does take power, and by the way, you're right, that Fidel and Che Guevara both learned from the lesson of Guatemala that you can't basically, within that period, this Dulles, with the shadow of Alan Dulles and these hardline national security interests in the United States, that was virtually impossible for a Latin American country in those years to emerge from that colonial state without confronting American power in some way. And so what Fidel learned from Che learned from Guatemala is that you have to arm your revolution, and you have to be prepared to militarize your revolution, and which is what they did. And that made them, of course, even more of a direct threat to these U.S. imperial interests there. So they quickly go about trying to undermine Castro. And in fact, while Castro was at a U.N. Meeting in 1960 in New York, he's forced to go up to Harlem because no hotel will take his delegation. Because the Eisenhower administration is pressuring, New York to basically give him a cold shoulder. But he's warmly welcomed at Hotel Teresa in Harlem, and it becomes an embarrassment to the Eisenhower administration. And world leaders are coming up to Harlem, and this is the beginning of the civil rights movement.
That's where Malcolm X had his office.
Yeah. That's right. Malcolm X comes to meet with Fidel in a famous meeting at the Hotel Teresa. Well, just blocks away at the Plaza Hotel, the CIA is meeting with the mafia. They're conspiring to kill Fidel. So, I mean, it really began there. And, you know, Alan Dulles essentially created a very lethal killing team that went around the world enforcing the CIA's will, killing leaders, some of whom we know about, or targeting leaders, but also leaders that were under the radar, many of whom we don't know about, as I said earlier, union organizers, journalists, opposition political figures. And so this was a beast that we had unleashed around the world, in Africa, in Latin America, and it was a very, I think, ominous development for America itself and for American democracy to be running this kind of murder racket.
David, let's turn domestically. What was the origin of Dulles's hatred of JFK?
Well, you know, Dulles met young JFK when he was still a senator. He just recovered from back surgery when they first met at the Kennedy home in Palm Beach, Florida. He was very weak physically at that point. He seemed very young. And Dulles thought, this is the kind of guy I could take under my wing. There are many people in Congress who Dulles did, in fact, kind of mentor and manipulate in various ways. He was very close to Prescott Bush, the head of that dynasty, who Senator Prescott Bush from Connecticut was basically the CIA's man on Capitol Hill. So he thought, you know, here was another wealthy...
That was George Bush's father.
That's right, George H.W. Bush's
yes.
father. And so he thought Kennedy was another, you know, wealthy young guy whose, you know, political ambitions, and he and his brother could kind of steer him in the right direction. But Kennedy kind of starts to break away, actually, from the Dulles Cold War ideology as senator. He speaks out against the French colonial war in Vietnam. He speaks out against the French colonial war in Algeria. He says that these rising third world countries have a right to their own destinies. And he says that's the correct path for America to take, not to stand in the way of history, but to actually allow these countries to find their own paths and their own destinies. Well, this is, you know, a direct affront, of course, to the Dulles worldview that these countries should be under our thumb in different ways. And so he starts to break away from the Dulles, you know, worldview then. But the real clash is when Kennedy becomes president. And he decides, I think, fatefully, to keep Alan Dulles on as CIA director. He thinks he needs to show that kind of continuity because he's won the White House by such a slim margin. He keeps some figures from the Eisenhower era in his administration. But they lead him astray at the Bay of Pigs in April 1961. The CIA, you know, persuades him this is going to be a quiet and clean operation, that they can go in with this kind of motley brigade of 1,100 Cuban exiles and easily overthrow Fidel Castro. Well, of course, that was absurd, and Dulles, I believe, as I write in my book, knew that it was absurd all along, and the plan, his secret plan, was after this initial invasion bogged down, he thought he could then manipulate this young president into sending the full power of the U.S. military into Cuba and overthrowing Castro. Well, Kennedy shocks him by standing his ground, says, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to blow this up into an international incident. I'm not going to send in the U.S. military. And, of course, the invasion fails. And shortly thereafter, Kennedy, who's furious with Dulles for giving him wrong intelligence and basically trying to sandbag him, fires Dulles and his two top deputies, and Dulles, again, doesn't get the memo. This is consistent throughout his whole career, where he basically defies one president after the next. After being forced out by Kennedy in November 61, he goes home to Georgetown in Washington, and he proceeds to operate as if he's still running the CIA. He keeps meeting with his top deputies and field agents, including some very suspicious characters who will come up later in a kind of a sinister way in our history. And he begins to essentially set up an anti-Kennedy government in exile.
Let me read to you, because I want to turn our attention in the final segment of our discussion to the assassination of JFK. And let me read to you a short paragraph that you wrote on that in the book. Over the final months of the JFK presidency, a clear consensus took shape within America's deep state. Kennedy was a national security threat. For the good of the country, he must be removed. And Dulles was the only man with the stature, connections, and decisive will to make something of this enormity happen. He had already assembled a killing machine to operate overseas. Now he prepared to bring it home to Dallas. All that his establishment colleagues had to do was to look the other way, as they always did when Dulles took executive action. Let's talk about the Kennedy assassination. I know that you believe Dulles had a central role in that, and I wanted you to talk to us about that, please.
Well, look, I think just the evidence, and admittedly, it's circumstantial. We don't have a confession from Dulles. We don't have a smoking gun. The CIA doesn't operate that way. This is a very secretive world. But I think the overwhelming circumstantial evidence does point to Alan Dulles' central involvement in the assassination and certainly the cover-up, because, of course, he served on the Warren Commission conveniently as well, the investigative body that looked into the assassination. But, you know, here's a man who does have this bitter falling out with the president, does think the president is weak, that he wants to be loved by the world instead of respected and feared. Alan Dulles said that in a speech in the final months of Kennedy's presidency. And this reflects this hatred of Kennedy as a weak president, as an appeaser, someone who's trying to make peace with Khrushchev in Russia and with Castro in Havana. This reflects not just his own feeling, but the circle of the power elite, as I say, this deep state, this group of men on Wall Street and in Washington who seem to, you know, go from one administration to the next, no matter who happens to be elected. You know, there was a growing feeling within this circle that Kennedy was an aberrant president by trying to end the Cold War. And you know, imagine if the president had come in at the height of the war on terror, like an Obama, instead of going along with the war in Afghanistan Iraq had begun to break from that kind of overwhelming, you know, reign of fear, and said, "No, we can, you know, find a different way towards peace, a different path towards peace." There would have been, of course, an enormous backlash against a president like that today, and that's what was going on with Kennedy in the early '60s. And Dulles was the kind of executor of this group. He was the most well-connected. He had the connections on Wall Street. He had the connections in Washington, the national security world, and overseas, and in the Texas oil industry, who were his clients. He was kind of Dick Cheney on steroids. There was no more powerful figure in America in those days than Alan Dulles. But he would never have acted alone. He was acting in a way that represented the will of his group, his power group. And we know that, I know, as I say in the book, for the first time, we know that the person he put in charge of the CIA assassination team, who was in charge of the CIA mafia operation to kill Castro, a man, a very violent man named William Harvey, who Alan Dulles had put in charge of that killing team, he was spotted by his own deputy flying from Rome, where Harvey was stationed at the time, to Dallas in early November 1963, shortly before the assassination of the president. He had no official reason to be there. And in fact, he's one of a number of people who were connected to the Dulles assassination team who were indeed, by their own words or by the evidence of others, spotted in Dallas in November 1963.
And you haven't been able to get the travel vouchers from the CIA, have you?
That's right. So we could pin this down. You know, I believe that Harvey's deputy was a very credible source. He was a very respected CIA veteran. Mark Wyatt was his name. And he told his grown children the story, and he suspected Harvey was indeed deeply involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. But we could confirm his travel to Dallas if the CIA would release his travel vouchers, William Harvey's travel vouchers. I applied to the CIA under the Freedom of Information Act through my attorney for those records, and they refused to release them. In fact, the CIA to this day, in defiance of federal law, has refused to release over 1,100 key documents related to the Kennedy assassination. So what are they hiding 50 years later? The American people have a right to this history, and yet they continue to stonewall.
David, why do you say that the Warren Commission was really the Dulles Commission, and how was the assassination covered up?
Well, of course, immediately after the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald and then, of course, his convenient assassination, and by the way, Bobby Kennedy, the attorney general, who was an expert on organized crime, he'd come, in fact, his career was made as a top investigator into organized crime, working with the Senate Rackets Committee in the 1950s. Bobby Kennedy, as I've documented, immediately when he looked into Jack Ruby's shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald in the basement of the Dallas police station, immediately figured out that Jack Ruby was essentially a mafia errand boy. So we know that the CIA was already working with the mafia to kill Castro, that they used the mafia to do its dirty work. And I believe it's clear, and Bobby Kennedy figured this out right away, that Jack Ruby was used to silence Oswald because he knew too much. I believe that they were very fearful that if Oswald had lived, he would begin to pull up the strings of this plot. I believe that he was a patsy, just as he shouted out to the press in the Dallas police station, Oswald. And I believe he thought he was playing some sort of low-level intelligence role. His mother, Marguerite, told the press that. And I think what the biggest fears that Alan Dulles and the CIA had was that if there was a true investigation into this crime, the sort of intelligence connections to Oswald, tying Oswald to agencies like the CIA would begin to come out. You know, Senator Richard Schweiker, who did one of the first legitimate investigations into Dallas when he was on the Church Committee in the 1970s, he said, when you look at Lee Harvey Oswald, you see the fingerprints of intelligence all over him. And that's what Dulles, when he was on the Warren Commission, was determined not to come out. So you see again and again how Dulles misdirected the commission, pointed them in every direction other than to look at the possible connections between Oswald and the intelligence establishment.
David Talbot is the author of an extremely important new book called The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David, is it fair to say that Alan Dulles was not a deviant, but was really accomplishing the goals of the American establishment and that he laid the foundation for the kind of state that we're living in now?
Well, exactly, and thank you for saying my book's important, and that's exactly why I think the book is important. This isn't just history that doesn't matter today. This is history that has direct relevance on what America is going through today. We are involved in an epic struggle between democracy and secret government.
David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
David, you've really provided a real public service. It's a tour de force. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Heidi. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Bye-bye.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, David.
you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.